When we were at our team meeting to plan this service, Katie asked me, well, why did you join this group, Cindy? I stopped and thought, why did I? I don't feel like I've personally been racist, but I do know that I'm a part of the white society's public policy that's brought us to where we are today with racism. For years, I've read fiction, gaining an emotional sense of the black experience and the white privilege from which I benefit. But it's been my recent reading in nonfiction that's opened my eyes as I learned the history I was not taught. The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's Great Migration by Isabel Wilkerson, tells, through intimate stories, the fleeing of 6 million African Americans from the Jim Crow of the South. 6 million people who left the only place they ever knew for what they hoped would be a better life on alien soil. The Great Migration lasted from World War I to 1970 and was one of the largest internal migrations in U.S. history. As Wilkerson points out, in a just world, they shouldn't have had to uproot themselves to experience the full rights of citizenship. Birth in this country alone should have assured that for them. The realities of race and caste in the South forced them to leave to claim their citizenship. After Lydia's sermon, I read The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness by Michelle Alexander. I realized that although I might not have a personal act of discrimination I want to rectify, I am part of a society who consciously and deliberately conceived of and implements the war on drugs public policy. Racial minorities are more likely than white Americans to be arrested. Once arrested, they're more likely to be convicted. And once convicted, they're more likely to face stiff sentences. And once labeled a felon, they will be discriminated against legally for the rest of their lives with laws that operate to ensure that the vast majority of convicted offenders will never integrate into mainstream white society, cementing the segregation. From 1999 to 2005, African Americans constituted about 13% of the drug users, but they made up 46% of the drug convictions. Arrests for possession of marijuana accounted for nearly 80% of the growth in drug arrests in the 1990s. What if that had been me? If police were busting down doors at frat houses or in the suburbs, this policy would have changed. As Alexander points out, all racial caste systems, not just mass incarceration, have been supported by racial indifference, a lack of caring and compassion for people of other races. Then there were the deaths of Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, and Freddie Gray at the hands of police. So why do we have segregated black neighborhoods where citizens are disproportionately rounded up for drug arrest and strong-armed police tactics that result in death? In 1968, following more than 100 urban riots nationwide, the Presidential Kerner Commission reported, what white Americans have never fully understood, but that the Negro can never forget, is that white society is deeply implicated in the ghetto. White institutions created it, white institutions maintain it, and white society condones it. It's easy to feel hopeless when it seems like, as a society, we're not progressing. But I'm not indifferent, and I don't condone the public policies in place that perpetuate segregation and disenfranchisement. I'll continue to educate myself about the issues affecting blacks in this country. I'm starting conversations about what I'm learning to my family, friends, and my coworkers, and I'm going to participate in actions with our racial justice task force. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Larry Lavender, and I've spent some time in jail. Buddhists assert that everything is connected: earth, air, water, fire, and the fifth element, all living creatures. Charles Darwin grasps that we are connected deeply in time to the ghosts of past species. We are connected in mortality, as John Donne told us, never to send to see for whom the bell tolls. And today, genetic scientists have sprung, have discovered that there is no genetic basis for the popular fiction we call race. We all sprang from the same African mother eons ago. All of the purported features of racial superiority are just plain cultural fiction. What we experience as racial is a cultural meme which is promulgated to keep an elite ruling class in power by creating fear and suspicion of a scapegoated group that is oppressed by the denial of civil rights, which leads to poverty, poor education, by underfunding of schools and teachers, by other political strategies, poll taxes, gerrymandering, voter suppression, by legal policies such as unjust laws like segregation or failure to enforce just laws, and by aggressive policing such as arresting for people for driving while black. I didn't meet a person of color until I was a sophomore in high school. I realized right away that the stereotype did not fit. We became fast friends, and I realized that through this relationship, not to fear other people that I had been taught to fear. In the 70s, I was doing youth ministry, retreats for a team with a team, reaching out to young people with a message of love. And after years of doing that, an opportunity arose to bring retreats to inmates in the Worcester House of Correction. It was a difficult decision, but in the shadow of our own fears, we hoped to find connection. We hoped to find allies and to be allies. And we did, and we were. Coming of age in the 60s during the Civil Rights Revolution caused many of my generation to ally ourselves against our parents' generation and their secretive and aggressive government. We were inclined to be more suspicious of Uncle Sam than we were of our black fellow students. We knew that the police took notice of us because we had long hair and beards, and that was probable cause for illegal search and seizure and ill treatment. And they were afraid of us. In the shadow of those turbulent years, I found myself walking into a prison looking for young people who needed allies. What did I think I was doing? The surroundings were bleak. The inmates called the guards screws, and some tried hard to live up to that moniker. When we met our inmate group, it dawned on me for the first time that racism had real life consequences. 90% of our inmate friends were black or Hispanic, and only 10% were white. Not a statistic you would expect in a just society. Over time, the inmates came to trust us. We read poetry and sang songs together. Over the many retreats and years, we became friends. Jail is the bottom of the pile where all the mistakes of public policy come to rest. It is the legal limbo where our cultural fears and mistaken beliefs find expression in the lives of those without the resources to mount a legal defense. Most of the inmates I came to know were not dangerous. They got caught with pot, and they happened to be black or Hispanic. But prison is a institution that is habit-forming by design. When our friends were released, they would return, having broken parole one way or another, usually because they either did not have a family or their family didn't want them. And So they ended up with their old friends, got into their old activities, got caught again, and they were back. We came to realize that this was a problem, and the group of us that were putting on the retreats got together and had a dream of getting a halfway house together. It was called Dismas House. Over the years, we raised funds, got a mortgage for a house in Worcester, not a too fancy part of town, and we hired staff. We had some rules, and the most important part of what we did was we provided a safe place for them to be until they found a job. We helped them with that effort. We provided meals from the community once a night, every day, and people were provided with the opportunity to go to a 12-step program. That simple effort reduced recidivism by 83%. And now 20 years later, that simple halfway house dream that we had is still going strong. It's expanded into two other homes. It's the recognized halfway house thing for the state of Massachusetts. And I think one of the most thrilling parts of the whole thing is that when I was last there, allies that we found in prison were bringing meals to the new people who showed up. So we're all connected. No one stands alone. And I want you to know that if you are interested in reading the new Jim Crow book, you can see me after the service. I'm going to do a group order. We are having a group of people who are going to be doing a book study.
Good morning. My name is Jean Canella. I was enrolled at Morgan State University, a historically black college in Baltimore, Maryland. In a class of 30, I was one of three white students in the doctoral social policy tract of the graduate school. One of the last classes I took was one that focused on integrating the knowledge and thoughts that we investigated during previous classes. And the only grade in this class would come from a paper, topic of our choice, that evidenced the ability to integrate and synthesize knowledge gained from the other classes and readings. I started on the paper immediately and handed it in and waited. I assure you, I am not obsessed with grades. My brother did that. I got the paper back after a week of the professor taking a look at it with, quote, good synthesis of information written on the front. I flipped through and found okay, good, interesting thought written on almost every page. Then I looked at the grade. It was a B minus. What? I flipped through it again and found one spelling error. Damn the spell check. I informally checked around, of course, and found everyone else had an A in the class. I was the only one with the B, and I was the only white student in this class. I fumed about this for the rest of the class and expressed concern to Dr. Jackson as I drove her home. Now, Dr. Jackson was not the professor of the class, the paper I handed in. But I had had her for a couple of other classes previous to this one, And she didn't like to drive home at night by herself, so I would drive her home. She lived in my neighborhood. And I told her about this incident, and she said to me, "How do you feel about this?" And I said, and these are almost an exact quote, "I felt puzzled, disappointed, frustrated, and angry." So then she said, "Well, why do you think you got the grade?" And I did not hesitate to tell her, "Because I'm a white student." There was a nanosecond of a pause, and Dr. Jackson sighed out loud and said, "Now you know how we feel." On the Social Justice Task Force, I'm hoping to work towards sustainable justice for people of color in education, housing, job opportunities, healthcare, and in society in general. So now I would like to ask you, what has been percolating in you as you participated in this service? Where are you on the continuum of involvement in racial justice work, including what are you learning? How are you speaking up? When are you speaking up? And how are you acting in regard to social justice issues? And the third thing I'd like to ask is, what is your experience of working already in the area of social justice? So I've thrown those three questions out, and what I would like you to do is, I would like you to be in conversation with the person either in front of you or behind you. And I'm specifically saying not the person next to you, because you probably know that person really well. So I'd like you to find someone that you are not familiar with or that familiar with, and ask yourself, you know, what have I been thinking during the time of this service? Where am I in the whole area and realm of social work, racial social justice work? And we will have approximately 6 minutes. And I'd like you to listen first, and then I would like you to tell your story. I'd like you to tell your part of it, okay? And we'll stop you in 3 minutes and ask you to change people, change speaker, and then go on from there, okay? All right, so get comfortable.
I am experiencing an awakening. How my perceptions have changed since last August, when Michael Brown was shot in the street by a Ferguson police officer. At that time, I focused on what Mike Brown had done to get his fate, stealing and roughing up the store owner and confronting the police officer. I didn't have a lot of sympathy for him. But then, when the results of the federal investigation of the Ferguson Police Department came out, I became outraged. It put Michael Brown's story in a whole new light. The police routinely targeted African Americans for minor traffic stops, and then they trumped up the charges. So instead of one minor traffic violation, they ended up with numerous charges and court fees and fines that compounded. It was an established way to raise funds for the city budget, by fleecing those least able to pay. Now that really got me mad. I started to wonder what other local governments criminalize people of color as a budget line item. what else was going on that I didn't know about? So I started to read and searched on Facebook, and evidence of seriously bad situations came flooding in. Articles and cell phone videos showing African Americans routinely harassed and targeted and killed while living their daily lives in ways that my family would never experience. My heart was breaking, and I felt like I had to do something. Something against this injustice that was eerily invisible in my white existence. And like Cindy mentioned, Reverend Lydia's new Jim Crow service in January, that threw a bucket of water over my head and made me wake up even more. She reminded us that a fundamental belief of our faith is that all people have inherent worth and dignity. At the end of her sermon, Lydia said, "Awakening is surely a spiritual calling, and complacency is an awfully painful place to live." And that filled my heart. During the benediction, Reverend Lydia called us to action. She said, "Will we challenge ourselves and each other and work for justice?" My heart welled up in my throat, and I called out, "Yes, we can!" And then I got embarrassed. But I knew that I had to put my broken heart into action, or I would have a really bitter feeling about my complacent self. So I sent out an email to see who else at this congregation wanted to start a dialogue about racial justice. Who else is outraged or brokenhearted and wanted to do something? And Katie Wiley and I attended an organizing meeting that just happened to be going on just then in Boulder for the group called Showing Up for Racial Justice, or SURGE. And at that meeting, national SURGE organizers came and met with a lot of different interested people who showed up. And they said that now is the time for white people to confront the system of oppression that benefits white people at the expense of people of color, but to do so in a spirit of love and compassion. And that really spoke to me. Then I started attending panel discussions, and I heard stories, personal stories, of Black Coloradans telling of the subtle and not so subtle harassment that they endure. And I listened to talks by Kenny Wiley. He's a young African American staffer at the Prairie Unitarian Universalist Church in Parker here in Colorado. And he said, "Together, as people of faith, we can make a difference. It will take white people to make the change, as Black people cannot do it alone. Our African American brothers and sisters are calling us to stand with them and to speak up for justice so all of us can be free. Their advice to us is to get ourselves educated and then show up. We need to say, this system is wrong and I'm not going along with it anymore." So starting in March, Katie and I convened meetings here at BVUUF, and over 20 people have showed up, sharing their ideas and enthusiasm that we can actually do something. Our Racial Justice Task Force will offer a variety of opportunities for our congregation to engage in racial justice, realizing that each one of us is in a different place on that continuum of between awareness and action, and a desire for action. So as Larry mentioned, Scott Yeomans and Gwen Murphy will soon be facilitating a book group to read and reflect together on the new Jim Crow book. And inside your bulletin is an insert that has a lot of different opportunities for things that are going on, including information about when that book club is going to be meeting. And like Larry said, you can get your book now. Start reading. Our Racial Justice Task Force will create opportunities for us to learn about the history of race in America and to reflect on our own personal racial identity journeys. We will host movie nights, and we'll support public actions led by people of color organizations and partner with the church in Boulder, partner with the Unitarian churches in Denver, partner with the Jews as Black allies in Boulder. There's just a lot going on, a lot of things that we can tie into and be a part of. And we can respond to the Unitarian Universalist Association's Action of Immediate Witness to support the Black Lives Matter movement and that was approved at the UU General Assembly just this last month. And we can begin a conversation about obtaining a UU-inspired Black Lives Matter banner, as other congregations have done across the country. And with our hearts and our minds opening, as President Obama said at Reverend Clemente Pinckney's funeral, we need to make a moral choice to change this country. We cannot expect a transformation in race relations overnight, but we also cannot allow ourselves to slip back into a comfortable silence or into cynicism. So let us rise up in love for collective freedom, knowing that together we can make a difference. Let it be so.